from KQED.
Welcome to this morning's forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Retired Supreme Court Justice John Paul Stevens died yesterday at the age of 99. He was appointed in 1975 by Republican President Gerald Ford, and Justice Stevens came to side with the court's liberal wing. He was known for his forceful dissent in the Heller case, which recognized an individual's constitutional right to possess a firearm, his call to abolish the death penalty, and his scathing indictment of the court's opinion on Citizens United, writing that it, quote, threatens to undermine the integrity of elected institutions across the nation, end quote. Justice Stevens, retired from the bench in 2010 at the age of 90, and in this segment we're going to discuss his judicial legacy. Joining us is Vikram Amar, Dean of the University of Illinois College of the Law. He clerked for Justice Harry Blackmun in the United States Supreme Court. And Vikram Amar, good to have you back with us. Welcome.
Thank you, Michael. Nice to be back with you.
And nice also to have Rory Little back with us. He's here in studio, professor of law at UC Hastings College of the Law. These guys used to teach together, in fact, at one time. Rory Little, clerk for Justice Stevens, 1984, 1985, and welcome, Rory Little.
Yeah, good morning, Michael. It's a sad day for us, but thank you.
Sad day, but one where we can really remember a judge who had an enormous impact on the court. He was often talked about as the liberal icon and the leader of the liberal wing and so forth, served 34 years. And I'm talking about 1975 to 2010, over 1,000 opinions, so it's difficult to sort out really what his legacy has been. But that liberal judgment actually falls in the face of someone who said, well, you know, I've always been a conservative and I did one case at a time. The court got more conservative. It wasn't me that was conservative.
Well, that was certainly his position, that he didn't change, the times changed. He certainly was a modest and humble guy, but probably the most brilliant judge I've ever had the pleasure of meeting. And he wasn't afraid to admit a mistake. So he admitted later that his death penalty vote in 1976 was the biggest mistake of his career.
He also was outspoken, and this is one of the things he's most remembered for, in the Bush-Gore we call it election? Yes, it was an election, as I recall. But he thought it was an infamous day for the United States, really, didn't he?
Yeah, he said that the greatest damage was really to the reputation of the court. That opinion, 5-4, which allowed President Bush to become the president over Al Gore, was decided in a rush. And most people think the opinions were badly done. And the court itself has really never relied on that case again.
And I was interested, Vikram, in reading Dinaram, let's call you by your title here. There's an article that Jeff Toobin did in The New Yorker, and he said really he was kind of one of a dying breed. He was a modest or a moderate Republican, not only modest, but a moderate Republican, and in a tradition that we would say maybe not only Harry Blackmun, who you clerk for, but Potter Stewart was. They don't seem to exist anymore. And what about that context?
He was a Northern Republican at a time before the Republican Party became so concentrated in the South. So he came in as a Republican and he left as a Democrat, essentially. He retired in order to give his seat to President Obama, a fellow Illinoisan. President Obama was extremely lauding of Justice Stevens. So I think it's true that the court and the country both changed beneath him, and especially the Republican Party. The Republican Party of John Paul Stevens was a very different entity than the Republican Party in 2010 when he stepped down. And I think that also relates to the big job that he had to do to serve the President Ford, who appointed him. John Paul Stevens was the anti-Watergate president, justice, the anti-Watergate voice. And he was really a personal embodiment of a repudiation of Richard Nixon in his personality and also his—
Forgive me, though. He actually was first appointed by Richard Nixon, who had never met him.
He was to the Seventh Circuit in 1970. He served in Chicago for 5 years. But if you look back at some of the big opinions, and Rory and you discussed one of them, the dissent in Bush versus Gore, another big ruling was he wrote the majority in Clinton versus Jones, which allowed Paula Jones to proceed with her lawsuit against Bill Clinton. And if there's a unifying theme in many of his big decisions, even the dissent in Citizens United, is that American democracy is in trouble. No one's above the law. We have to make sure that our institutions serve us and corruption and excess don't run the day.
Well, there were some reversals, Rory, we need to talk about those, not only on capital punishment, but he became in favor of abortion rights, for example. He took the Bakke case is quite famous, and that goes back to UC Davis, and he was in favor, essentially, of affirmative action, at least with college admissions.
You know, he was in favor of affirmative action in a number of causes because he thought they were right. He thought they were constitutionally correct. Small anecdote, the term that I clerked, I believe of 35 or 36 law clerks, there was one African-American among the bunch, and that clerk worked for Justice Stevens. So Justice Stevens didn't wear it on his sleeve, but he certainly was shaped from a different generation. You know, his military service in World War II, he had a commitment to sort of a patriotic vision of America as a land of democracy and the people. He dissented in the case that says you have a First Amendment right to burn the flag. He said, boy, the flag is too important for that. So, yeah, he's a different generation, and I think you're right. We don't see justices like that nominated or confirmed anymore.
And Tom Brokaw called it the greatest generation for good reasons like you're citing here, but also treatment of detainees at Guantanamo.
Yeah, another huge, really, victory for Justice Stevens. Again, standing up to executive branch authority. The position of the government was you can't even review the conditions of confinement in Guantanamo. You can't even review the military tribunals. And he met, really, over time, three opinions in the mid-2000s set up a doctrine which is very important even today for the due process rights of aliens, of people arrested on the battlefield and then put into a POW camp, things like that. It's a great legacy.
And it's also important to say, Vic Amar, particularly in the context that we're living in presently, that he was not exactly all that favorable toward executive power, or at least he felt it should be limited.
Right. And again, that's a product of the times of Watergate. I mean, the big job after Watergate was to prove to the country that the president is not above the law. So even though Clinton versus Jones, the Paula Jones case, may not actually be correctly legally decided, there's actually a decent argument that presidents should have temporary immunity from civil lawsuits while they're in the White House so they can run the free world. But it was very important for him and others of that generation to send that message. A couple of points. You know, he did come to favor affirmative action, certainly in his personal practice and later in his votes. But in Bakke, he wrote for the conservatives. He was against affirmative action as a constitutional matter in Bakke. And the flag burning case just illustrates how quirky he was. He was a very independent mind. You know, this was a core First Amendment traditional free speech challenge, and he ruled against it. Probably not one of his finer moments. That his opinion in Texas versus Johnson, the flag burning case, was not one of his great opinions. But he was a hard guy to pigeonhole. He was a hard guy to predict. He really often he wrote for himself sometimes, and you really didn't know as an oralist or as a lawyer exactly where he might come out on any given case.
And Rory Little, actually, you wrote a piece in the SCOTUS blog, which I read and commend you for, but about how he really was a warrior with respect to prosecutorial ethics and, well, shall we describe it as unprofessional conduct or misconduct of prosecutors?
Yeah, this is something people don't know well about him, but he was consistently in favor of the idea that prosecutors must turn over all evidence, including any possible exculpatory evidence. One of his first opinions was a case called Augers, where many people believe he got the law better in that case than anybody has since.
This is a case involving a prostitute and a guy essentially who was probably responsible for her death. I mean, it was a self-defense case.
Yeah, she killed the guy, but her defense was self-defense, and the prosecution hadn't revealed that the guy had previously been convicted for carrying a knife and things like that. But he had a personal history here. His father, they were a wealthy family in Chicago with a big hotel, and then his father was indicted and convicted for fraud. That was reversed a year later by the Illinois Supreme Court, saying there was no evidence to support it. But this plunged his family into a real economic problem. And he, I think, for the rest of his life was very suspicious of prosecutors and willing to keep them in check. Again, prosecutors are part of the executive branch, so I think Vic is exactly right, Vic Amar, when he says there's a real theme here of anti-executive branch authority. It's not just Watergate. It goes all the way back to when he was a kid. By the way, Stevens always famously would tell you, the first thing he'd tell you, he was present in Wrigley Field when Babe Ruth called the home run shot.
A major fan of the Cubs. And also, you mentioned his father's experience. His father was indicted for embezzlement. He had a Stevens Hotel in Chicago. It was a big deal. I mean, also a hotel builder. Won't go there, though. Let me invite our listeners. In fact, you can come here and join us, and we invite you to do that now. If you have memories of Judge Stevens, or if you'd like to comment about his legacy, we're talking about really a major legacy of someone who served on the Supreme Court from 1975 to 2010 and just died yesterday. We'd like to hear your thoughts, and maybe some of your thoughts may be related to where we are now on the Supreme Court. I was just reading about Judge Kavanaugh and New Time magazine. There's a whole portrait of what we can expect perhaps from him, and what we can expect isn't necessarily in the tradition of what we had going for Judge Stevens. Our toll-free number is available, and you are welcome to be part of the program. The number to call is 866-733-6786. We welcome your calls, and please feel free to join us now. The number again, 866-733-6786. Or if you'd like to be part of the program, you can also join us by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or going to our website and posting questions or comments there at kqed.org/forum, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. We're talking with Vic Amar. He's dean of the University of Illinois College of Law. He clerked for Justice Harry Blackmun, the United States Supreme Court, and Rory Little, who's with us in studio, professor of law at UC Hastings College of the Law, who clerked for Judge Stevens in 1984-1985. And one important point here, Vic Amar, is to what extent, and really a strong, profound sense, that when we think of this judge's legacy, this justice's legacy, he was a strong believer in an independent judiciary.
He clearly was, and he embodied that in his own independence with respect to the court itself. He was not somebody who was necessarily a joiner with the conservatives or the liberals. Indeed, even the theme that Rory and I have been trying to develop regarding executive constraint is he's not a guy who is necessarily going to be predictable in every case. One of the biggest cases he authored is kind of under the radar. It's called Chevron versus NRDC. It involves administrative law and the extent to which courts should defer to the executive branch in interpreting law. Chevron is under a lot of pressure today, but Chevron has been for a generation kind of an icon of broad executive power. And he wrote an opinion that he may not have realized was going to open the door to that direction. But the two things that strike me most about Justice Stevens, and I don't know him personally as well as Rory does, of course, but he struck me always as just such a great, decent, honorable human being and someone who was very, very, very independent of mind.
And one of the things I mentioned, Rory, an article by Jeff Toobin in The New Yorker, which was really a send-off to and a memorializing of Judge Stevens and all that he stood for. But he pointed out that essentially people have talked about President Trump overturning all of Obama's so much of what Obama stood for, and so much of what he brought forward. Toobin says that most of what Trump is dedicated to overturning can be seen in terms of what Stevens stood for. Let me give you some examples of what he's talking about. He's talking about equal rights for women. He's talking about civil rights for gays. He was talking about essentially gun regulation or some form of gun regulation. In other words, you just go down the list, separation of church and state. There are a number of things that really tie in with what we associate now with this presidency and really what Judge Stevens was totally countering.
Well, I think that's exactly right. Of course, the Republican Party silently, but I think actively, is divided on President Trump itself.
And forgive me, let me add limits of presidential power to that, too.
Yeah. You know, there's a group called Republicans for the Rule of Law, which is a number of prominent Republicans, pretty well funded, which is placing ads against Trump and his policies. You don't see Republicans like Justice Stevens anymore. And I think President Trump is warring against not just a sort of a vision of Justice Stevens or you know, he is changing the American ethic today. And Justice Stevens would be and is highly disappointed. I was at a reunion 2 months ago in Florida with Justice Stevens. He's totally on top of it, intellectually just fine. And he said again, he said, boy, the court got it wrong in Heller. They got it wrong in Citizens United. The current administration is going in the wrong direction. And I hope you 200 of my clerks will go out and do good.
Can either of you law professors solve a mystery for me? And that is, I never understood why Nixon picked him back in 1970. I mean, he was a Republican back then. I think Chuck Percy had something to do with it. Senator Chuck Percy was a senator from Illinois. But at the same time, Nixon had never even met
You know, in the old days, the senators chose their judges unless they were Supreme Court, and the presidents deferred to the local senators. And so, yeah, he was purely—
That was customary, really. Yeah,
he was a purely Illinois pick, and he had led, prior to this, a strong independent commission to investigate a part of the Illinois state government and had exposed a number of fraudulent things that caused the resignation of a number of people. He was sort of a folk hero in that small world of Chicago politics.
And we're going to go to callers. And again, you can join us. We invite you to do that at our toll-free number. If you have memories of Judge Stevens or if you'd like to talk about Judge Stevens' legacy, we'd like to hear from you. The number to call is 866-733-6786. Here's James. James, join us. You're on the air.
Hi.
Yeah,
thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So I also just wanted to point out, he did write the majority opinion in the Kelo case, which really was just an atrocious decision for property owners and really not a good moment for him.
You want to comment on that, Vikram?
Sure. Kelo is a case that upholds the power of government to use eminent domain for economic redevelopment. And I guess I would say about Kelo, it was really dictated by past precedent. A lot of political hay was made of the ruling, but if the court had come out another way, it would have had to essentially overrule a lot of cases. So, you know, that's one that people have a lot of strong views about. But as a matter of constitutional law, under the Fifth Amendment, a just compensation takings clause, that's a very different question than the political question of how eminent domain ought to be used.
Let me thank the caller. You were talking before, Rory Lill, about his skepticism of the Bakke case and on the other side of affirmative action there. But he was also, as has been pointed out by Vikram, at one time supportive of the state death penalty and felt regretful of that. So he was someone who was maybe pragmatic and certainly could change and be fluid in his opinions. But he's also skeptical of some of the free speech claims, especially involving sexual speech.
Well, I'm not sure what you mean by sexual speech, but
well, let me thought just, it was obscenity and that sort of thing,
well,
or pornographic.
So he came from an older generation when the Supreme Court struggled with the meaning of obscenity. He wasn't happy about the idea that the court should even be doing that. I think he was comfortable with pushing obscenity off into a non-protected category. You know, he gave a lecture back at Fordham probably 10 years ago called "Learning on the Job." And he was the first to admit that when you're a Supreme Court justice, you learn on the job, that it's not the same as being any other kind of federal judge, let alone a lawyer. And he was humble enough to admit that he learned on the job. So his views on affirmative action, I think, evolved. I think he learned from people he served with. He always said that Justice Marshall taught him a lot of things that he didn't know. And so his skepticism in certain areas is judicially based maybe in a certain generational view, but he was at least willing to change. Many justices today seem to be absolutely unwilling to even consider changing their views.
Let's talk about this with you, Vikramara. I mean, what constituted his change on the death penalty, for example?
Well, I think in some ways the affirmative action and the death penalty debates are interlinked because during the course of Justice Stevens' tenure on the Supreme Court, it became ever more clear how the death penalty really worked much more harshly against blacks in America than other groups. So I think, you know, the journey that he had was not unlike the journey that my former boss Harry Blackmun had, where in principle the idea that some crimes warrant execution may not be out of bounds. But if you look at how the death penalty is administered, who has resources to avoid the death sentence in the first place, which kind of people get wrongly convicted, those are really big factors in moving someone on that particular issue. And those are not dissimilar to the same kinds of factors of access and resources and equity that informed, I think, his move from Bakke to the University of Michigan affirmative action cases.
And again, Vikramara is dean of the University of Illinois College of the Law. And let me go to a comment here from Madge to you, Rory Lill. Madge wants to know, what do guests know of Justice Stevens' opinions regarding Trump, Kavanaugh, and the Republican Party post-Trump? There is a sense of those old style Republicans, as I alluded to before, like Jacob Javits or Tom Campbell here in the Bay Area, Chuck Percy, you know, you can go through the list, not existing anymore. This is the party of Donald Trump now. Do you know what his feelings were about Trump?
Well, yeah. I mean, I was present at this reunion a couple months ago, and he said some unfavorable things. Towards the end, he was sort of publicly commenting on issues. He actually was concerned about this. He asked his former clerks, do you think I should be doing this? He said something about Justice Kavanaugh, during the nomination process that he didn't think Kavanaugh was appropriately nominated or should
didn't have the temperament, I think, is what
he
said.
Yeah, it was after Kavanaugh's outrageously angry nationally televised talk. He had a sense of propriety about him and sort of properly staying in your lane, right, staying in your role, that he would no doubt be very disappointed today to see where things are going. One of his first opinions was to strike down a federal rule barring people from working for the federal government if they were aliens, even if they were legitimately papered aliens. He struck that down in 1976. He would, if he heard the go back to where you came from remark today, there's no doubt he'd be outraged.
What about his reputation, Vic Amar, the leader of the liberal wing of the Supreme Court? That was the handle he had for years.
Well, you know, when he got to the court, obviously there were people like William Brennan and Thurgood Marshall who were the leader of the liberal wing. And then when they retired, it really fell on Harry Blackmun to be the leader of the liberal wing. After Blackmun retired, Stevens had moved to the left, and in some ways the liberal wing had changed as well. I don't think of John Paul Stevens as liberal in the way that I do William O. Douglas or Bill Brennan or Thurgood Marshall. As I said, Stevens dissented in Texas versus Johnson. He said that someone does not have a right to burn the flag to express himself. I mean, it's a terribly wrong-headed First Amendment decision that reflects his instincts weren't consistently liberal so much as they were kind of based on his sense of fairness and independence of mind and, as Rory said, willingness to learn, evolve, listen going forward. But the other thing is, you know, you look at someone over 35 years on the bench, they're really not a single person. They're multiple people during that whole time.
I think Joe Biden would like to hear that said.
I think cases like Harry Blackmun and John Paul Stevens, they really do cause us to ask, and I'm not posing an answer to this, I really am posing the question, does it really make sense for people to serve that long and be appointed by a president and be formed by an era that is so distant from the ones that they're resolving down the road? I think a sensible system would probably have, you know, an 18-year cycle for a Supreme Court justice, and people then would retire kind of on a schedule rather than picking which president they want to give their vacancy to.
Well, we've had this discussion. It's an ongoing debate. Should there be a lifetime appointment? And what about if a justice becomes senile or has other kinds of problems? Then the nation would certainly have problems. But he did, I think it's fair to say, isn't it, Rory Little? He did set up a majority kind of with the liberal wing. I mean, O'Connor would often vote with him. Kennedy would often vote with him. And the result of that was that he used to not write that many majority opinions, but he started writing a lot of them, didn't he?
Well, I think he discovered, as Vic says, that he was suddenly the leading justice for a certain point of view because some others had left the court. Vic and I probably disagree on life tenure. I think life tenure right now looks really important for the federal judges who are on the bench and opposing certain Trump administration initiatives. We probably disagree on Texas versus Johnson. I would certainly agree with Vic that people do change over time and the issues change over time. I think Justice Stevens did try to answer every single case the way he thought it should come out legally as well as morally. And I think that is a valuable perspective that you don't see so much anymore.
Here's Niley. Niley, you're on the air with us. Welcome to Forum.
Oh, hi. Thank you for taking my call. I'm actually just interested more about the history of Justice Stevens, like civil rights thoughts, and really looking at today, you know, what we're going through with this whole comment from Donald Trump stating that, you know, go back to where you come from is actually breaking the EEOC's laws of civil rights violation against discrimination is classified as textbook discrimination, and what you think that he would think about that
well,
from a civil rights history of Judge Stevens.
raising a couple of very important questions. Let's first talk about the civil rights legacy that Niley brought up. Go to you on this, Vic Amar.
Yeah, I mean, as we've been discussing, whether it's racial equality or criminal justice, you know, there was a gradual but pretty consistent drift to the left as Justice Stevens got more experience as a justice. That happened to a lot of justices, David Souter, Harry Blackmun, et cetera. Rory knows him better personally, but I think my guess is Justice Stevens was aghast to hear these comments by the president. He would think they're completely inappropriate. Whether he thinks that that's a technical violation of the law, that's a whole other matter, and whether the EEOC regulations apply to the president, who, of course, oversees the EEOC. These are all very complicated technical legal matters. But Justice Stevens is the kind of person who would never, ever, ever be uncivil the way we get used to hearing on a daily basis these days.
Well, you can't read his mind, Rory, but you knew him. And to some extent, I think what Vic Amar is saying is probably true. He would be aghast.
Well, I'm sure Vic is right about that. I mean, I don't want to canonize Justice Stevens. He'd be the first to say, you know, I'm no saint. I'm not perfect. An unmined area for Justice Stevens is in the 1960s when there was a civil rights movement in the late 1950s, he was busy founding a law firm in Chicago which did antitrust work.
It was a corporate law firm, yeah.
Well, it was mostly antitrust work, too, yeah. and attacking monopolies, which in the 1960s was actually viewed as a civil rights issue by itself to break up Ma Bell. But he wasn't out on the hustings, you know, marching, which is why he always was quite eager to hear from Justice Marshall on issues like that.
Quick question from a listener who wants to know where he stood on the Fairness Doctrine. Do we know, Rory?
I really don't know. I think that he had mixed views about his Texas versus Johnson flag burning decision was sort of an outlier for him. He said the flag is sort of absolutely special.
Sacred.
Otherwise, he was pretty much a strong defender of the freedom of speech.
Yeah. Well, thank you both. This has been an important segment to note the legacy of Judge Stevens, and I appreciate having you both with us. Again, Rory Lewis, professor of law at UC Hastings College of the Law, clerk for Justice Stevens, 1984-1985. Thank you, Rory.
Thank you very much.
And thanks to Vic Amar, dean at the University of Illinois College of the Law, clerk for Justice Blackmun, Harry A. Blackmun, the United States Supreme Court. Good to have you back with us, Vic.
Thank you, Michael. Take care.
You too. And thank you, all our listeners, and remind you that there is another hour of Forum up ahead. We're going to talk about difficult subject, rape. There's a new article in The Atlantic by Barbara Haggerty, and you will want to hear what she has to say. Stay tuned. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation and by Jan Schramm and Maria Minetti Schramm, founders of the Minetti Schramm Museum of Art at UC Davis, which preserves the legacy of renowned artists such as Wayne Thiebaud for future innovators by dedicating a third of its space to arts education.